Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Ukrainian president's appearance before a joint session of Congress, where he made a plea for U.S. military hardware over and above the non-lethal assistance Ukraine is getting, stating that one cannot win a war with blankets. Robert English, a professor of international relations at USC, who formerly worked as a policy analyst for the United States Department of Defense and the Committee for National Security, joins us to discuss the possibility that Ukraine's Petro Poroshenko is courting the more hawkish Congress to put pressure on Obama to arm the Ukrainians at a point where there is a stalemate that is inviting a diplomatic settlement. Then, as Scots go to the polls in record numbers, we'll look at the political ineptitude of British Prime Minister David Cameron, who has missed signals at every turn that the up or down referendum he decided on could blow up in his face, as his complacent ministers ignored warnings from civil service professionals that the no vote was not a sure thing and that the United Kingdom could soon be split in half. James Cronin, a professor of history at Boston College and an associate at the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, where he chairs the British Study Group, joins us to discuss Cameron's self-inflicted political wounds as his actions threaten to take the great out of Great Britain. Then finally, we will examine the out-of-control outbreak of Ebola in West Africa, which the United Nations Security Council has called a threat to global security. Gregory Koblenz, a professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs at George Mason University and a member of the Scientist Working Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons at the Center for Arms Control and author of Living Weapons, Biological Warfare and International Security, joins us to discuss the role of the Pentagon in combating Ebola in Liberia and the virulence of Ebola that was weaponized as a biological weapon in the former Soviet Union. And joining us now is Robert English, who's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California, who studies Russia, the former USSR, and Eastern Europe, and formerly worked as a policy analyst for the United States Department of Defense and the Committee for National Security. He is currently working on a study entitled Our Serbian Brethren, History, Myth, and the Politics of Russian National Identity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert English.
Thank you.
And Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, addressed a joint session of Congress on Thursday where I guess the sort of takeaway line was where he was arguing that Ukraine needs military hardware, real weapons, etc. And while they're appreciative that they're getting non-lethal assistance, he basically said, you know, we can't win a war with blankets. And he did get rousing applause from the Congress. So what's going on here? The Congress, of course, also voted to go to war against ISIS in both Iraq and Syria. So they seem to be, at least in terms of the applause, they seem to be on board with the idea of supplying military hardware.
There's not only a temporal link, but maybe one of substance as well. And that's the following. If I were a member of Congress, I would also, not just in the case of weapons to the so-called moderate Syrian opposition, but in the case of weapons to the Ukrainian government, have to be concerned that they could fall into the wrong hands. We're not used to thinking about Ukraine as anything like Syria. But, you know, those of us who look more closely at the conduct of military operations, at people selling arms, even to their own opponents because they're so corrupt or cash-strapped. And this is a general incompetence with which much of the Ukrainian operation has been conducted. I'm not sure I'd want to be sending arms there, or they could end up shooting in the wrong direction. That's the first thing I'd say. It's not clear-cut. It feels good morally, right, to support the underdog, but it doesn't always work out well. The second, however, it's curious politically that in a way Poroshenko, the new Ukrainian president, is wooing the Congress to his side and maybe against the president. And by that I mean strong signs that President Obama and sort of central Germany, France, the main European leaders, have been quietly, like openly, they're highly critical of Russia and they blame Russia for almost everything in Ukraine. But privately, there's a lot of evidence that they've been urging Poroshenko to try to meet Russia halfway to end this crisis. And we've seen that breakthrough in a new legislation granting quite a bit of autonomy to the Russian-speaking eastern regions, cultural, linguistic autonomy, some local self-government. You know, so they pushed him to make that concession, but he's not happy about it. And so it's kind of ironic that he goes to the Congress, where, of course, passions are stronger. There's so much more criticism of this weak or timid President Obama. And naturally, that's where he makes his pitch for arms. He's pressing the president through the U.S. Congress.
So I take it the president must be aware of this, right?
Certainly. It's part of his larger diplomatic game, and I suppose that a little more leverage to hope that maybe not large-scale provision of arms will come out of it, but rather just a somewhat stiffer support for the Ukrainian position, because there's a lot to still be negotiated. I'm hopeful that this concession on local autonomy for the East is the start of a real broader settlement. But there are so many details to be worked out, and Poroshenko would still like to have the U.S. In his corner as strongly as possible, and where they are haggling over the details to support him and not Russia.
But surely any lethal military assistance to Ukraine by the United States would further play into Putin's narrative, which is what he's telling the Russian people and what they're believing, because he controls the press in a ubiquitous way. Already, the NATO exercise on the Polish-Ukraine border has been painted in the Russian press as an example of American imperialism and NATO moving east and planning to go to war against Russia. So it seems to me that Obama's trying to keep this thing from boiling over. And Poroshenko, if he's trying to get Congress on his side, knowing how much they hate Obama, that seems to be playing with fire. And in general, you know, I don't understand why NATO has been so blind in pushing so hard in its movement eastward. I mean, as if we didn't notice or somehow didn't realize what happened in 2008 in Georgia. Wasn't Putin sending us a pretty strong signal then that that's his red line? And then if you push further, as we did in Ukraine, to me, it's not entirely, it shouldn't have been a complete surprise that Putin said, okay, you've crossed the line enough already.
No, I agree across the board. I don't think the Congress will successfully authorize, over some objection from the president, lethal aid. It's leverage. It's sort of the threat of military measures to toughen the political response. But on the larger question about the origins of this, no doubt, our coverage in the West has generally been so one-sided. It's nothing like the propaganda from Moscow, but it's still been one-sided nonetheless. So we have focused on the justice of the Ukrainian cause without much attention to Russian sensitivities and Russia insecurity about NATO's continuing encroachment, about Western military bases ever closer right on the Russian frontier. I agree. It's become a tragic self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, the threat that NATO was created to avoid didn't exist in the 1990s or even the early 2000s. But all the way through that decade and a half, NATO has continued to push towards Russia. And now that Russia's pushing back, there's the threat. It's very sad, very unnecessary.
And of course, a lot's being made of this statement attributed to Vladimir Putin in the German press, where in a conversation with Petro Poroshenko, his Ukrainian counterpart, Putin is reported to have said, "If I wanted, in 2 days I could have Russian troops not only in Kiev, but also in Riga, Vilnius, Tallinn, Warsaw, and Bucharest."
It's context is everything. That's an incredibly scary statement when looked at from one perspective. He's threatening to reconquer Eastern Europe and keep going. But that's not what it was. In a sense, it was the opposite. For those who are alarmed and believe that Putin is trying to reassemble the old Soviet Union, he was saying, look, if that were my goal, I would have done it long ago. In 2008, there was this essentially a skirmish, a small war with Georgia, and Moscow could have swallowed Georgia immediately had it chose to. But it essentially restrained itself to supporting those breakaway regions that were having their own problems right, an inter-Georgian dispute, if you will. And again, if Putin wanted to take all of Ukraine, he would have done it long ago, or he would have, at a minimum, launched a full-scale invasion of eastern Ukraine instead of this sort of insurrection and surreptitiously supporting separatists. So he's saying, I believe the correct interpretation was, you know, don't be stupid. Stop painting me as Hitler or some kind of return of the Soviet Union. If that were my goal, I would have done it long ago, and I still could do it now. But you know what? This, you know, takes us to another important point. He really couldn't do that. Militarily, of course, that conquest could be executed, but it couldn't be held. It couldn't be digested.
No, it would be a catastrophe. And in fact, I don't think he could go much further into Ukraine because of the possibility of guerrilla warfare.
The irony here is Putin or Russia could not conquer even half, much less all of Ukraine, and hold on to it without a nightmare scenario. But you know what? The Ukrainians can't reconquer eastern Ukraine in that way either, and rule by force, rule by occupation.
Right.
There are lots of people there. There already were so many who were alienated from the Ukrainian nationalism coming from Kiev. And now that so many lives have been lost, so many civilian lives, for which, by the way, Ukrainian forces are also responsible, there's no going back to just, you know, to conquest and centralized unitary rule as before. The compromise every sensible person has seen from, you know, from November or December on, certainly since the spring. And we're finally seeing movement in that direction, which is a partial federalization or greater autonomy and guaranteed language rights for the Russian-speaking population. And I think there's finally, did we really need all this fighting to get to this point? Maybe we did because of the way domestic politics work in each country, but we're finally getting inching towards what we should have leaped towards 6 months ago.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert English, who's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California, who studies Russia, the former USSR, and Eastern Europe, and formerly worked as a policy analyst for the United States Department of Defense and the Committee for National Security. He's currently working on a study entitled Our Serbian Brethren, History, Myth, and the Politics of Russian National Identity. But I've been criticized in mail for being hard on Putin, but I'm certainly not hard on Putin in the way that this alarmist idea of him taking over the world and being aggressive and all of this stuff that's been going on in the Western press. My concerns about him come from my friends in Russia who are just in despair that they've lost press freedom, they've lost the rule of law, there's no politics anymore. It's just a sort of dull dictatorship, and that Putin has played the politics of xenophobia and homophobia and you know, the analogy would be here in the United States. He's become, you know, a sort of right-wing Tea Party Republican Southerner, you know. So that's, you know, that's what I'm concerned about is, you know, what he's doing domestically to his own people and to that hope for Russian democracy.
Well, I share those concerns and have nothing particular to find issue with in your characterization. It's dismal. It's depressing. It's a retreat from democracy. And all I can add is that conflict only worsens nationalism and the kind of rally around the flag, the we're willing to sacrifice economic or political interests for the unity of our state. This conflict has just played into Putin. So what am I saying indirectly? Without disagreeing on Putin's consolidation of power and his dictatorial tendencies, is why make it easier for him by fumbling the Ukraine crisis and so much else as we have?
Right, and having military.
It's not to differ in all in any way about the loss of democratic freedoms and press freedoms in Russia. All the same, let me add something else. Again, trying to get people to think of it from a different perspective. You mentioned in passing homophobia, and people remember the laws against so-called propaganda of gay, lesbian, transsexual rights and so forth. Also the jailing, the persecution of the Pussy Riot, performance rock group. All that happened sort of leading up to and during the time of the Sochi Olympics. And we hear that shorthand, Putin's homophobia, Putin's anti-gay law. This is what really happened. Over the 2000s, over years preceding that issue exploding onto the national stage in Russia, various municipalities, regions, governors, and local elected bodies, one by one, passed their own local or regional anti-gay or homophobic laws and measures. And, of course, they were strongly supported in this by a very conservative Russian Orthodox Church. This was not started or orchestrated by Putin, and when it reached the national level, and when legislation was first discussed for the national parliament, right, for the Duma, Putin spoke out and said, wait a minute, we have to be careful here. These people are Russian citizens too, meaning Russian homosexuals. They have rights too. And he made other comments that showed he was concerned about how this would play in the West, that it would be embarrassing. That's what Putin initially said. But the groundswell, again, of religious nationalist groups and just, let's face it, very conservative grassroots attitudes on the part of the majority of the Russian population caused him to jump on board. He did not lead, he followed. It wasn't properly speaking his law, even though later, of course, he embraced it and said all kinds of things that suggested he supported it. So my question to listeners, to you, is how is he any different from President Obama, who, of course, was for marriage between a man and a woman and very cautious on this issue up until 2012, when opinion polls showed that Americans' opinions had shifted, and now a slight majority had said, we have no opposition to civil unions or marriages for gays. It was only in the midst of the 2012 reelection campaign that Obama came out and said that he was in favor as well. Of course, Obama isn't Putin. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that they're both politicians, and neither one has gotten very far out in front of public opinion. They haven't really led or taken, you know, politically risky principled positions. And they've constantly had focus groups and opinion polls to stay on the right side of the issue as they see it. Okay.
Well, I think though that the only point that I would make, Robert English, is that my understanding is that those massive demonstrations against Putin when he decided to have a third term caught him by surprise, and I think he was kind of personally peeved at the intelligentsia and the middle class and the business community, that he feels like, I'm the guy who made you guys rich, and now you turned against me. So then he, out of pique, he then turns to the narod, to the country, and to what's the equivalent in America of the religious right, and throws his lot in with the Orthodox Church and all of the
conservatives, nationalists, exactly. Yeah. No, again, no doubt. And this is not to say that it's enormously disturbing and depressing for Russia's, let's say, hoped for return to more liberal ways for a post-Putin Russia, that he's done what he's done, the centralization of power.
Right.
But he will pass the scene one day. There'll be a fight over the spoils, oligarchs, rich businessmen supporting different candidates. And I'm, you know, optimistic in the long run that things will return to a moderately reformist path, but not overnight.
Well, let's just...
And not only because of this horrific setback that the Ukraine crisis has caused. And again, unnecessarily. The damage has, however, been done. But also because culturally, Russia was never as Western. I'm talking about a majority of public opinion, not just the urban intelligentsia. But Russia was never that Western, that prepared for democracy, that adaptable to free enterprise, as we assumed it would be. Don't forget, we went into Iraq thinking that all we had to do was topple a dictator and the free market would work its magic. And we were setting up stock markets and private health systems and all the rest. What fools we were to think that a people coming out of Saddam Hussein's long dictatorship, all they needed was the shackles removed and they'd be just like Americans.
I just wanted to quickly touch one. We're running out of time. I just want to touch on one more piece of news from Russia, and that is that a Russian billionaire, Vladimir Yevtushenkov, has been placed under house arrest, and The rumor is that this is the same MO as Hodorkovsky, who, of course, was jailed because he got involved in politics. This guy hasn't gotten involved in politics, but my understanding is that the Siloviki, the people around the cronies of Putin's, basically, particularly Igor Seshin, who owns Rosneft, another oil company, he has his eyes on this guy's oil company, Bashneft. And is that what's going on here? That this and my question would be, has Putin lost control of the Siloviki? Are they just getting too greedy and out of hand?
The answer to the first question is I don't know, but very likely that's correct. It's a power play. It's a grab. It's about money, not ideology, at least in large measure. But as for Putin losing control, I don't think so. He would have had to, in general terms, if not specifics, approve this. It's far too bold a step, with international implications, especially at this sensitive moment, that anybody, that any general or CEO or well-connected Silovik, as you say, power ministry official, would do it on their own. That's inconceivable still. Putin's control remains very strong.
Well, the economy has already taken a hit as a result of it. I mean, the Western business are nervous again, you know, that you can't do business there if people are just going to be arbitrarily jailed and their assets confiscated by cronies of the Kremlin.
There's another way to read that. Not that you're incorrect in what you said, but all the more reason to have control over more of that one commodity that will always find a lucrative market abroad, petroleum. Right? You could be absolutely correct that this climate has already chilled investment. There's been capital flight. The outlook is now for recession, not economic growth. But if you can get a piece of an oil company in the midst of all that, you'll ride it out just fine.
Well, Robert English, I thank you so much. I appreciate your much more, I think, incisive analysis of what's happening in Russia.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert English, who's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California, who studies Russia, the former USSR, and Eastern Europe, and formerly worked as a policy analyst for the United States Department of Defense and the Committee on National Security. He is currently working on a study entitled Our Serbian Brethren, History, Myth, and the Politics of Russian National Identity. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking at the political ineptitude of British Prime Minister David Cameron. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Cronin, who's a professor of history at Boston College and an associate of the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, where he chairs the British Study Group and serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of Social History and British Politics. He's the author of Industrial Conflict in Modern Britain, Labour and Society in Modern Britain, The Politics of State Expansion, New Labour's Pasts, and most recently, What's Left of the Left. He is currently writing a book on British and American foreign policy and the Anglo-American relationship since the 1970s. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Cronin.
Thank you very much.
And the coverage that I've been doing on this Scottish independence vote, particularly speaking to political analysts and political scientists and journalists in England and in Scotland at St Andrews, the impression I get is that this thing has been politically fairly badly bungled by Prime Minister Cameron. Is that your understanding?
Well, he made a set of calculations which turned out not to be correct. If I were in his position, I'm not sure I'd have done anything different, but in retrospect, it certainly seems as though he may have made some mistakes. But he also, I think, fell into a sort of trap. In fact, the whole No campaign fell into a kind of trap that Alex Salmond and the SNP set, which was, you know, the way Salmond and the Yes camp decided to structure the campaign, the pitch they made. It was hard to counter, I think. I could explain that more if you like.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, it seems to me that the Yes campaign argued on the one hand that many good things would flow to Scotland with independence, but they at the same time really downplayed the dramatic character of the changes that might occur. It's not just that they didn't anticipate quite the debate over the currency, but they told people that, you know, we will keep the Queen, we will keep the pound, we will stay in the EU and do that easily, we will stay in NATO. And so that sort of rosy or optimistic picture, I think, put the no camp in a difficult position, because for them to say, no, it's going to be worse, it's going to be miserable, it's going to be difficult, and we in Britain might make it more difficult for you. I think they chose the no camp, chose not to approach it that way. They kind of poked holes around the edges of the Yes campaign's claims, but they didn't take them on fully. And they didn't take them on fully because they didn't want to appear to be bullying and threatening, which they felt would provoke a counter-reaction and support for Salmond. So it was not irrational for the No camp to take its approach, but it was very smart for the Yes camp to approach things in this very positive way, forcing the other side to go negative, which they were in turn reluctant to do.
And, of course, I think the No side, the British side, are constrained by the fact that they're not Scottish. And that isn't what it's at the heart of this, the fact that there's the joke that there are more Pandas in Scotland than there are Tories. So you have this complete lack of political representation in terms of the politics of Scotland versus the politics of the UK.
I think that's true, and it's the reason why the No camp, as it has been, you know, served in Scotland, has been served mostly by Labour politicians. Alistair Darling, obviously, has been the head of the No campaign, the Better Together campaign, and recently he's been bolstered by Gordon Brown, who is a genuine Scot. And
right, Mr. Charisma. Mr. Charisma, right?
Exactly.
I mean, and they're fighting for their political survival, Labour, aren't they? They'll become a minority party if Yes happens.
Yes. As you know, it would happen in two steps. The first step might be they win an election this coming May, are in power, and then if there's a Yes vote and Scotland removes itself in March of 2016, as they wish, those Scottish MPs who are part of the Labour majority would disappear, the majority would disappear, and I don't know what we'd do, but it would be very confusing and very difficult.
Well, but that leads me to the next self-inflicted political wound, and this one I think is more graver in terms of the viability of the UK and of Britain as a power and having its legitimacy on the UN Security Council. In other words, if the Yes vote happens, Labour wins the next election, but then they subsequently lose their majority because of the Yes vote in Scotland, then there's another election, and then the Tories get in, then Cameron has to go ahead with this insane referendum that he's promised to placate his right wing, this anti-EU wing of the Conservative Party. And if they vote their way out of the European Union, Britain will be further diminished.
It seems that way, doesn't it? Obviously, there are a lot of stages in what you've laid out, and things could change at any stage, but it's quite a plausible scenario that one could end up with Britain diminished very quickly and then choose to diminish its role further by leaving the EU. That's certainly possible. It would be a strange outcome, but particularly for Tories to be in favor of that, who traditionally want Britain, as they say, to punch above its weight in international affairs. It'd be strange for them to lead Britain to that particular pass, but it could happen. Yes.
But in many ways, I'm told that British Labour has the same problem that the Democrats have, and that is that they've gravitated towards Wall Street or the City of London to get their funds and have somewhat alienated their own base. And that, you know, they're having a hard time getting people to the polls, which I think is certainly the case with the Democrats in this upcoming midterms.
I think that that's true. Obviously, Tony Blair was able to overcome that, but as you suggest, he may have done it at a price that accentuates the long-term problem of getting working-class voters to the polls. On the other hand, as you also know, it's a problem that's clearly visible in Britain. It's clearly visible here in the United States, and it's pretty common in other parts of Europe. I mean, the decline of working-class voters in terms of numbers, their lack of attachment or involvement in trade unions and socialist politics or social democratic politics is a pretty broad phenomenon, and it's a little less developed in Scotland, so Scotland remains further to the left than Britain in its political culture. But it's not unique to Britain or to New Labour and Tony Blair and his successors.
And, of course, there is the other phenomenon that's going on the opposite end of the spectrum, and that is the right-wing nationalism, which I mentioned earlier in terms of that referendum to get out of the EU, largely driven by people like Nigel Farage. But throughout Europe, in Hungary in particular, you have the rise of these right-wing parties, and most of the nationalism that I've detected that's going on in Europe tends to be on the right. The Scots seem to be an exception there.
I think you're right. Possibly things are not – possibly the people in Catalonia and in the Basque Country and in Flanders are not all right-wing or as right-wing as some of the other people you mentioned. But, yes, it is unique that the Scots represent in a funny kind of way in their nationalism a possibility of a more social democratic future. That's certainly the promise that Alex Salmond has made. Where they can deliver on that financially on their own as an independent country is tricky in terms of the finances, but that's the promise, and that's to me anyway rather encouraging.
So what's your impression of this? Because my understanding is that there's a real buoyancy and a real engagement going on in Scotland. This is really democracy at work. I think one of the great embarrassments and shames of our democracy here in the United States is how few people participate. Getting 60% of the electorate to the polls is considered a triumph. It's considered a banner year for American democracy. We're talking about 97% of the people are voting in this election in Scotland.
Well, I don't know if the number will come out that high. 90% of the people, percent of the Scots have registered. But yes, the turnout will be high, higher than anything we've seen here or people have seen in Britain in a long time. And that is encouraging. I quite agree. Whether it's the kind of phenomenon that will last is another thing. But it's clear the nationalists have captured or created a sense of momentum and enthusiasm that hasn't been seen many places before, and no place else at the moment. So yes, that's very encouraging. I quite agree. What happens if a huge turnout occurs and the Yes campaign helped to generate that turnout and that excitement, and then they don't win? I'm not quite sure. That would be interesting.
Well, the fact that there's a big turnout means, of course, that we won't have results until, I think, about 7 in the morning UK time on Friday. So
if then.
So we're somewhat speculating about the results here. But
we are.
You know, it's interesting that it's come down to a head versus of a heart argument, isn't it? So you don't know whether the head, which is no, is going to overcome the heart, which is yes. But
it's also hard to predict because, as you say, there are so many people voting who haven't voted before, including, of course, 16 and 17-year-olds. I'm honestly, to be slightly cynical, not sure I want to put my fate or the fate of my country in the hands of 16-year-olds, but that's another issue. But it does mean that the pollsters, even though they've recently settled on a 4 to 6 point lead for the no vote, it's not clear they really are in much of a position to predict because the electorate that they're sampling, they don't quite know how to sample it.
So when did this decision go to? I thought the voting age was 18, as it is here in the United States, but when did it get lowered to 16?
It got lowered just for this referendum, I believe. It was lowered by the Scottish Parliament. And the Nationalists have had control of that since 2011. I forget exactly when the lower voting age came into effect. It may have been in effect for European elections in the spring. I just don't remember. But it's certainly in effect now. Nobody knows what difference it'll make, but it's kind of interesting that, in a way, the nationalists have helped to kind of construct a new electorate, both with the addition of the young, but also the mobilization of previously apathetic or discouraged or at least not mobilized voters. So that's an achievement.
Well, but again, it leads you to wonder what kind of advice or strategy or vision that Cameron and these people have. They didn't see this coming. They didn't see the possibility that they were so smug that they were going to win, and they wanted to have a light footprint, and they barely campaigned in Scotland. I'm told that if he did campaign there, he'd probably be booed off the streets. But still,
yes.
You know, making it this kind of either-or stark choice that he did, now he's panicking, you know, throwing every sweetener into the mix that he can think of. I don't know. I mean, it goes back to my original question. I'm astounded at the lack of, I mean, here we are in the United States where everybody's piling on saying Obama is not up to the job. Well, God, compared to this guy, Cameron, Obama is an elder statesman.
Well, I think you're basically right. There clearly was great complacency about it. As I tried to suggest earlier, the way the campaign was conducted, the way the Yes campaign sort of controlled the discourse, the tone, that helped that reinforced that. But yes, clearly they were too complacent. And there are rumors, people have denied it, but rumors that I think are credible, that a number of the top civil servants, the people who actually run the government, told ministers, hey, you got to take this more seriously, and they ignored it. So they'll never confirm that was true, but I find it certainly very plausible.
Well, did you ever watch that BBC series, Yes, Minister?
Of course. In this case, those officials probably knew more than their political leaders.
That was the whole point of that series, was that the civil servants knew what was going on, and the politicians were absolute, you know, in airheads,
well,
I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose one of the reasons Cameron made this what seems like a strategic error was that he was so damn preoccupied with the right wing of his own party and this issue of Europe. And that's been a distraction, which I think may prove fatal. Well, we'll see how the vote comes out. But it certainly has been a big distraction. I mean, he's had lots to be distracted by.
Right, but can you believe that if it comes to the pass, as the scenario that we outlined earlier, that Yes wins, Cameron is politically disgraced, mm-hmm. Labour wins the next election, but because of the timetable with the Scottish vote, at, you know, I don't know how many months later, he loses 40 of his seats and therefore loses his parliamentary majority, the Tories then take over, and then Cameron has to go ahead with his pledge to have another referendum on getting out of Europe. At that point, if the right wing has prevailed, and one of the people I believe who's I spoke with, Polly Toynbee at the UK Guardian the other day, who said that the reason that there's all this anti-European fever is in large part because of Rupert Murdoch and his influence over the press. So if they vote to get out of Europe, you'd think that at that point the entire British establishment would weigh in. Wouldn't they be in a panic? I mean, they don't want to lose their seat on the UN Security Council. They don't want the City of London to become irrelevant as a banking center. Surely they must be able, at that point, see the writing on the wall.
Well, if they wait that long, it'll be too late. One piece that I read somewhere today suggested, I think it was in the FT, that the Financial Times, that already elites in London, businessmen and others, Tory politicians, are sitting up and taking note of how unpredictable, potentially dangerous a referendum can be, at least for what they want to see happen, and that they're already deciding it's time to begin to mobilize in a pro-European direction. Now, whether that'll happen or not, I don't know. But I think that there will be certainly lessons learned from this referendum. I also think that if if the Tories come back after Labour's in and then out, they won't be led at that point by David Cameron. He will be replaced by somebody else,
right.
Just who, we don't know. It could be somebody more pro-European or even someone who's more anti-European. So I think, I guess the choices are George Osborne or Boris Johnson, and that could be scary.
Well, James Cronin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with James Cronin, who's a professor of history at Boston College and an associate of the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, where he chairs the British Study Group and serves on the editorial boards of the Journal of Social History and British Politics. He's the author of Industrial Conflict in Modern Britain, Labour and Society in Modern Britain, The Politics of State Expansion, New Labour's Pasts, and most recently, What's Left of the Left. He is currently writing a book on British and American foreign policy and the Anglo-American relationship since the 1970s. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the Pentagon's role in the out-of-control outbreak of Ebola in West Africa. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gregory Koblenz, who is a professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs and Deputy Director of the Biodefense Graduate Program at George Mason University. He's a research affiliate with the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a member of the Scientists Working Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Living Weapons, Biological Warfare and International Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregory Koblenz.
Thank you for having me.
And the UN Security Council has just declared that the outbreak of Ebola in West Africa is an international crisis and a security threat to the world. That's pretty powerful statement, isn't it?
It is, and it's pretty much unprecedented coming from the Security Council, which usually deals with military threats to security. But the Ebola crisis has been so severe and the potential for it to spread outside of West Africa is so great that I think the Council was justified in declaring this a global threat, not just a regional one.
And this is a Council that's normally split with Russia and China against U.S., U.K., and France. So we know that the Pentagon is getting involved. Is there any evidence that the other permanent five members are going to pony up some aid, whether it's military or non-military?
Yeah, a number of the other members of the Security Council have already contributed assistance. China has dispatched a mobile lab team to the region. France and the UK and a lot of the European countries have also been very active supporting efforts on the ground. So there is already a pretty broad-based international coalition, but I think this Security Council resolution will be helpful because this outbreak is not going to end anytime soon. So the more help we can get from more countries, the better. And this resolution is a good way of achieving that.
Well, I had read earlier that Cuba has sent over, I think, 200 doctors and other healthcare workers. Is that your understanding?
I think they contributed about 165 doctors, nurses, epidemiologists, lab techs, which is very useful. And Cuba is a very active medical diplomacy program, so they're definitely playing an important role in combating this outbreak.
So, Gregory Koblenz, tell us what the Pentagon, first of all, why the Pentagon and what are they bringing to the table in terms of their deployment to Liberia?
So the main impetus for getting the military involved is that the scale and speed of this outbreak have really outstripped the resources of groups like the WHO and Médecins Sans Frontières and the other NGOs on the ground. And in order to try and contain the outbreak and start rolling it back, you're going to need much faster delivery of supplies, faster construction of treatment facilities, and the military has some unique assets that it can bring to bear to do that. So the military deployment that is has just started is going to have three major roles. One, our engineers will be building 17 treatment centers, each of which has about 100 beds in Liberia. The second role will be for training of healthcare workers to staff those treatment centers and provide training in how to treat victims, how to prevent infection, and how the workers can keep themselves safe. And finally, there's going to be a large logistical element. I think the U.S. is creating what's called an air bridge based in Senegal that will facilitate the flow of supplies into the region. And these are things that the U.S. is very well suited doing so on a large scale very quickly, and that's, I think, why the military is brought in the first place.
So in terms of the U.S. deployment of 3,000 military personnel, and as you've mentioned, they're mostly involved with building these mobile hospitals and providing sanitation equipment and training, et cetera. What about the security issues? Because there were reports earlier in this slum area of Liberia where the outbreak is particularly virulent. You know, they quarantined the area, the military quarantined the area, without giving the people any hope and any direction and any aid. And the people were, needless to say, restive. And what did the military do? They shot into crowds and killed a young boy. So is there any possibility of the U.S. military in any way being involved in security issues?
I think that's highly unlikely. I think even within Liberia, they realized that that was not the appropriate response, and they've moved back from that kind of containment strategy. It's much more focused now on outreach to communities and using social leaders to communicate with people and get people to come out of, basically come out of hiding and get treatment if they're sick, and to let the healthcare workers know where infected people might be. I don't see the U.S. being used to enforce a quarantine in any way. There are always concerns about safety and security, but it'll be purely self-protection.
One of the strangest stories that's coming out now, coming out of West Africa, is the idea that there's now a black market trade in blood. We know that the U.S. doctor, Kent Brantley, who was brought back to the CDC in Atlanta, his blood was used to treat an American aid worker, Rick Sacra, who was hospitalized in Omaha, Nebraska. But what do you know about the trade in blood? I mean, it sounds sort of ghoulish.
It does, and I haven't heard a lot about it, but it's not actually surprising. When these kinds of epidemics emerge seemingly out of nowhere, and when the public health system is falling apart, and when people are mistrustful of their government and of doctors, they'll turn to alternatives that even though are far-fetched or ghoulish or dangerous, offer some kind of hope. And so you see, people buying, either blood or, fake medicine or counterfeit medicine, or using kind of local religious practices as a way of trying to heal people. So, unfortunately, when people are driven to the edge and they're desperate, they will do desperate things. I think this is just another example of that.
Well, I'm sure you've seen pictures of these unfortunate people lying in the streets and sort of people milling about, or some people just walking by, ignoring them as though they were just refuse.
Yeah, no, it's really tragic. The human toll that this outbreak has inflicted, and the fact that unless there is a much more robust response, this is going to continue. And the longer it continues, the greater the risk that it will spread outside of the three current countries and will become a regional, if not a global problem.
So at this point, what do we know about the figures? So far, the World Health Organization is saying that about 5,000 people have been infected in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. although they acknowledge that the actual toll is much higher. I heard in a Pentagon press briefing yesterday that there was a need to move so fast, which is why the military were used, because the projections are that the Ebola spreads exponentially, and its days count. Weeks may be too late.
That's very true. The WHO and Medecins Sans Frontières have been warning for a couple of weeks now that the outbreak is spiraling out of control. And what that means is that more cases are being generated at a much faster rate so that the public health people just can't keep up. And for every person they track down who has the virus, right, they pretty much know that means that there are five or six or seven other people who have the virus who they don't know about. And so the longer this outbreak continues and the longer infected people are able to circulate in their communities and affect others, the harder this is to control.
Well, one of the fears, I believe, is that this Ebola strain may mutate and be able to be transmitted through the air. At this point, it's transmitted through contact of bodily fluids. What's your understanding on where the science is on that?
I'm not a virologist. I'll just say that up front. But I think that's a very unlikely scenario. We have a long history of other viruses like HIV that are bloodborne, that have had, you know, millions of chances to mutate and become airborne, and they haven't. So for a virus to change the way it's transmitted in such a fundamental way would require a huge revolutionary jump in its genetic code and its behavior, and I just think that's highly unlikely. So I think and what's proven is that, you know, Ebola is perfectly happy being a bloodborne and being passed along through bodily fluids. It's been very successful at that, so there's also not an incentive for it. There's no environmental pressures on it to change the way that it spreads naturally. So I think I don't think we need to be too worried about the airborne version of it in the near future.
But I recall when years ago interviewing the former deputy director of Biopreparat, which was the secret Soviet biological weapons program that, you know, as you know, back in the 1970s, President Nixon unilaterally got the U.S. out of biological weapons, and Russia agreed to an international convention, but then secretly maintained a massive program. And this fellow, Ken Allerbeck, who I spent some time with, was the deputy director of this program, and they were doing all kinds of unbelievable, scary stuff. Were they trying to? I think they were working on Ebola and Marburg, weren't they?
They were. And for a biological weapons program, the most effective way to disseminate a biological agent is to aerosolize it, is to turn it into a cloud of microscopic droplets that people can inhale. But that is a man-made outbreak that is different than Ebola on its own evolving the way to be transmitted that way. So, you know, Ebola can be transmitted, right, as a respiratory threat, but only if it's generated by, you know, a weapon or a device. It doesn't do that naturally.
So as bad as what we're having going on now in West Africa, during the Cold War, the Soviets were prepared to unleash a man-made version of Ebola that was infinitely more virulent and more deadly.
Yeah, the naturally occurring outbreaks are really stark reminders of the threat that diseases pose, both the natural outbreaks and the man-made versions, right? And especially in the U.S. and advanced industrialized countries, you know, diseases, you know, infectious disease is not a major public health threat, but that's not true for most of the rest of the world. And so this is, you know, unfortunately one of those cases that really reminds us of the fragility of the global health system.
But in terms of your book, Living Weapons, Biological Warfare and International Security, where do we stand on this? Because my understanding is that we're not entirely sure that the Russians have given up on this program, even though they say they have.
So when the Soviet Union fell apart and President Yeltsin took over Russia, he issued a decree banning biological weapons and reaffirming Russian compliance with the Biological Weapons Convention. However, since that time, the Russians have maintained a small number of military biological facilities that we believe had previously been involved with offensive research back during the Cold War, and these are facilities that remain secret and closed off to outsiders, and so we do not know what's going on inside of them. And so that does raise a certain level of concern about the extent to which the old Soviet program has lived on maybe in a dormant stage within Russia today.
And, of course, it's no accident that Yeltsin was the one that issued the decree banning Russian biological offensive weapons. He, after all, was the Communist Party chief in Sverdlovsk, a town in Siberia, when there was an outbreak of anthrax. The Soviets had put a biological weapons factory right in the middle of the town to avoid U.S. detection, and a worker forgot to put a filter in, and overnight all this anthrax was pumped out into the air, and people were dropping dead all over the place, and Yeltsin, being the boss of the city, was trying to find out what the hell was going on, and the KGB wouldn't tell him what was going on. So I imagine that was a pretty powerful lesson that he learned.
Yeah, I think that did have an effect on his approach to the problem, and it also illustrates the bigger problem of secrecy. When governments hide what's going on and they're not transparent, this hinders the public health response, and we've seen that, you know, in the Soviet response to Sverdlovsk. We've seen that in lots of other cases. So this is kind of a common lesson that a strong public health system requires transparency for the individuals to know how to avoid disease and how to get treatment, and for the medical and public health workers to know what to do as well.
But just to end on a more positive note, I guess, the fact that the UN Security Council have issued this unanimous decree, if you will, warning that the West African outbreak of Ebola is an international crisis and a threat to global security, I take it that's something that we can feel is at least heading in a positive direction.
Yeah, I think it's a good sign that the UN Security Council has recognized the gravity of the situation, that the states that are on the council have put your unanimous agreement to this, and I do hope that helps galvanize other states to contribute even more to the effort, since this really is a global health challenge that needs to be met by the entire international community.
Well, Gregory Koblenz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Gregory Koblenz, who is a professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs and Deputy Director of the Biodefense Graduate Program at George Mason University. He is a research affiliate with the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a member of the Scientist Working Group on Chemical and Biological Weapons at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Living Weapons, Biological Warfare and International Security. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.